You're listening to Truth Quest with Melody on KHEN, LPFM Radio, 106.9, Salida, Colorado. We're streamed on the internet at khen.org, and Truth Quest programs are archived at www.givemesometruth.info. My co-host this evening is Dr. Eric Carlstrom, a professor of geography at California State University at Stanislaus. With nearly 30 years of teaching experience, his academic research has focused on using ancient soils, paleosols, and landforms as a means of reconstructing climates and environmental conditions of the past. And our special guest this evening, for whom I'll let Dr. Carlstrom introduce, is Don Easterbrook.
Okay, yeah, I'd like to introduce and welcome Dr. Don Easterbrook to our program. It's a real pleasure to have him here with us. He's a real expert on the subject of past climates, and I think to some extent also present and future climates. Let me begin with a little introduction to him here. Dr. Don J. Easterbrook is Emeritus Professor of Geology at Western Washington University, where he has conducted research on global climate change in Western North America, New Zealand, Argentina, and various other parts of the world for the past 48 years. He has written 3 textbooks and several other books, about 150 papers in professional journals, and has presented 30 research papers at international meetings in 12 countries. All of his research has been funded by the National Science Foundation and other U.S. government agencies. His research includes causes of abrupt global climate changes during and following the last ice age, relationship of cosmogenic isotopes in ice cores to climate change, the relationship of the approximately 30-year warming and cooling phases to modern global warming, and predictions of global climate change for the next century. Dr. Easterbrook is past president of the Quaternary Geology and Geology Division of the Geological Society of America, chairman of the 1977 National Geological Society of America meeting, U.S. representative to the United Nations International Geological Correlation Program, associate editor of the Geological Society of America Bulletin for 15 years, and director of field excursions for the 2003 International Quaternary Association Congress. He has been featured in 2 New York Times articles on global warming, March 2007 and March 2009, and has appeared on national network shows at MSNBC, CNN, CBS, and Fox. A full resume is available at his website, which I'll give right now, just in case people want to refer to that website as we have our interview here. He has a lot of information on this website. It is the best one would be myweb.ww.edu/dbunny/. Is that correct, Don?
That's right.
For your website? Yeah. In fact, I would invite our listeners, and which I think will probably include some of my students in the near future, to go to Don's website. As we make these discussions, they'll have some very interesting, colorful graphs, figures to refer to as well. Is that the correct website address, Don?
It is. You can go directly to the climate change part of that website by going to myweb, M-Y-W-E-B dot W-W-U dot E-D-U slash D-B-U-N-N-Y slash research slash global slash index dot H-T-M. Or an easier way to do it is just to Google Don Easterbrook Global Warming, and the first listing there that will pop up will be my website. You just click on that and you go right to it.
I was figuring that might be the case.
So again, to get on this website,
an easy way, hard way.
just Google Don Easterbrook and then go to his website. Well, Don, you have been working in the area of climate change, climate research for your entire career, as I understand it. You've done a lot of work on the glacial history of the Cascade area, which is in your backyard since you taught at Western Washington University. So you've watched this whole man-caused global warming issue coming down the railroad tracks like a big slow-moving train, I'm sure, as I have as well. Most Americans, or most people, and many people in the world now, are firmly convinced that the Earth is warming and that it's our fault. It's because we're using fossil fuels. But your research does not support that, does it?
No, the geologic research that I've done has resulted in accumulation of a lot of data, and this data includes fluctuations of glaciers all over the world in response to climate change. Glaciers are really sort of a paleothermometer. When it's warm, they retreat. When it's cold, they advance. And also including isotope work in the Greenland ice cores, which leaves a record of temperature in the ice that we can read by looking at the isotopes of oxygen. And also a lot of other proxies for climate change that leave a fingerprint, so to speak, in a geologic record that we can read. And what's abundantly clear is that there's no doubt that there's been global warming for the last 25 years. But that doesn't prove anything. I mean, the fact that there was some global warming for 30 years and there was an increase in CO2 doesn't mean anything, because for the first 30 years after CO2 started to soar after World War II, we had 30 years of global cooling, just the opposite. And my research has turned up 40 phases of global warming and cooling in the last 500 years alone. So there's nothing unusual at all about global warming. It doesn't prove anything about global the cause of global warming by CO2. I mean, hell, I had hair before global warming, and does that prove that my loss of hair caused global warming or vice versa? No, there's no relationship. So anyway, the short answer to the whole thing is it has nothing to do with science. It's all about politics, power, and money.
Okay. We have, Melody and I have had the opportunity to interview Dr. Tim Ball of Canada, and I think he comes to the same conclusion that the science has been corrupted and perverted and hijacked more or less by a political agenda. So perhaps this is a logical breakdown for us. We can look at both of those issues. But as somebody who's interested in climate change and quaternary climates, in a way, in a kind of a strange way, this whole political issue gives people like you and myself an opportunity to come forward and try to educate people to what actually has been learned about past climates. So maybe we should start with that. You say you've looking at the Greenland ice cores, you see evidence for repeated 30-year cycles of warming and cooling, go back 500 years, and that we're essentially in that now. We've warmed up until about 1999, between about 1970 and 99, and now we're cooling. So do we see any influence of human activity at all?
There's no correlation with human activity whatsoever. And just as an example, I'll give you two stories, one about the last century and another about the 500 years. And if we can go back, clear back to 15,000 years, and you'll be amazed at the climate changes that have occurred in the past with no possible influence of CO2 at all, that are way, way more intense than what we've been seeing in the last 22 years or so. For anybody who's following along on the website, if you were to go back to the homepage where it says climate changes, the sheet that, or the page that deals with climate changes, and click on glacial fluctuations past climate changes with no change in CO2, which is an icon in the middle, There are some interesting graphs in there which relate to what I'm going to be giving you a verbal picture of. So in the last century, we've had four climate changes, not just one, but four. From 1880 actually until about 1915, we had geologic cooling, and the cooling that took place was record-setting in that most of the temperature records for cold were set during that period. That is the recorded, observed periods of cooling. And then in 1915, it started to warm up, and it warmed up until 1945. And in fact, the warmest year of this century was not in the past decade, but was in 1934. The 1930s were actually just slightly warmer than what we have right now, so there's nothing unusual. And this happened before the big increase in atmospheric CO2, so you can't blame this warming on CO2. And that's acknowledged even by the people who were pushing CO2. And then in 1945, there was a climate change to global cooling. I mean, global cooling from 1945 to 1977 at a time when CO2 in the atmosphere was soaring. So instead of producing warming, it produced 30 years of global, it didn't produce it, but it went hand in hand with 30 years of global cooling. Again, which shows that CO2 had no influence whatsoever on the global temperature. And then in 1977, there was what's called the Great Climate Shift, where the temperatures in the oceans flipped abruptly from their cool mode to the warm mode. And that started what is now generally referred to as the recent global warming period. So 1977 to 1999, there was indeed global warming, no doubt about it. No big deal. It had already happened in the 30s without CO2, and it had happened lots of times before that. And then in 1999, the oceans, the Pacific Ocean in particular, flipped back from its warm phase into its cool phase. And 1998 temperatures have not been exceeded since then. In other words, we've had no global warming in 12 years. The 1998 temperature was part of the result of an El Nino year, which is a warm equatorial Pacific current that tends to warm the global climates. And so what we end up with then is a period of global cooling, global warming, global cooling, and global warming in the past century. Four switches. And so there's nothing unusual at all about the period of warming that took place from 1977 to 1999. The interesting thing is that the IPCC, the International UN panel that is behind all of this global warming CO2 push, they have computer models that they use to predict temperature, and their models are used to predict catastrophic warming of 10 degrees Fahrenheit or thereabouts by the end of the century. And their prediction for the time period from the 10-year period from year 2000 to 2010 was an increase in global temperature of 1 degree, which is more than we've had for the entire past century. But that was their computer prediction. And in fact, we've had global cooling. So their models do not work. And if their models were wrong for only a 10-year period, then why should we trust them for a 100-year period? And the only test you have of whether a computer model is valid or not is to check it against real data. And when you check it against real data, the computer model shows that it has failed. So that's the short-term story for the past century. And then for the past 500 years, I calculated the paleo temperatures for oxygen isotopes in the Greenland ice core, and the result was interesting. It showed that there were 40 temperature changes back to the year 1480, in other words, about 500 years, warm, cool, warm, cool, warm, cool, with an interval at an interval of about every 27 years was the average, so 25 to 30 years, which is the same as for the last century. So we're seeing the same pattern carried forward, and if you follow that pattern into the future, then the prediction would be that sometime after the year 2000, it should start cooling, and guess what? It's been cooling for 10 years. So that, in a nutshell, is at least part of the story for at least the explanation for warming and cooling over the past 500 years.
Okay, so essentially no role for human activities such as burning fossil fuels. We're looking at a natural cycle, which you identify with what you call the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, or the PDO, which also has an Atlantic Ocean counterpart, according to one of your recent papers, the Atlantic Multidecadal Oscillation. Could you explain the linkage then, and I know it's going to be a little complicated, but between, say, warming and cooling cycles, glacial advances and retreats, and what's happening in the Pacific and the Atlantic Ocean?
Sure. One of the things that I've done, and one of the clues that became apparent about 10 years ago, and I started predicting global cooling in 1999, which just by coincidence happened to be the year the Pacific Ocean flipped from its warm mode into its cool mode and brought on the cooling. But the whole picture of global warming and cooling is tied to the oceans. The ocean water temperatures pretty much govern how the Earth's climate is going to be. And the Pacific Ocean and the Atlantic Ocean have essentially two stable modes. One is warm and one is cool. And there isn't much in between. And they tend to flip back and forth like an on-off switch. And so when the Pacific Ocean switches from warm to cool, then the global climate follows suit almost immediately with global cooling. We've seen this, as I mentioned, four times in the last century. And so everything depends on what's going on in the oceans. In the Atlantic, it's much the same thing. There is what's called the AMO, which is the Atlantic Multidecadal Oscillation. It's very similar. And there's also a similar kind of a relationship in the southern hemisphere. And there's a southern oscillation, all of which go hand in hand together. And so what I'm saying is that the temperature of the oceans is the determining factor in what happens to global climates.
Don?
And the ocean has... Yes.
Do you have any idea what makes that flip?
I was just going to get to that.
Oh,
and
I'm sorry.
to point out that there is a really strong correlation between what's going on in the oceans and solar fluctuations. And there is one curve, which you'll find on my website, which shows the southern oscillation. This is the southern hemisphere oceanic temperature curve, plotted against a measure of solar variation, which can be measured in a couple of ways, in terms of sunspots or in terms of the sun's magnetic field. And if you plot what's called an AP index, which is the solar magnetic field versus the southern ocean temperature changes, you get a graph that goes up and down with a fairly high frequency. And it looks like two partners dancing together. The solar curve fits almost exactly on top of the ocean temperature curve. Having said that, we can say, okay, there's obviously a very strong correlation between solar variation and ocean temperature. We know the ocean temperature drives the climate. The climate is what makes the glaciers advance and retreat. So we can correlate all of these things very nicely. They all fit in together. All the curves fit together very nicely. But then when you ask the question, what's the mechanism whereby the solar variation affects the ocean water temperatures so quickly? And the short answer to that is we don't know. And instead of spending $9 billion a year with this CO2 nonsense, those are the kinds of things we ought to be investigating, because we won't know the real driving mechanisms and the mechanics of it all until we get a lot more data with respect to changes in the solar variability and the temperature of the oceans. So that's it in a nutshell.
Yeah, I think that's very well concisely stated, and thank you. Especially the part about wasting money, $9 billion a year, I guess, on CO2 investigation, when we could be looking for the mechanism by which changes in solar magnetic intensity translates into changes in temperature in the oceans, which then drives this series of causal mechanisms that drive the climate system, not well understood yet, and yet we could be putting our money there. Let me just ask you, there's been a lot written and studied about El Nino, or sometimes called El Nino Southern Oscillation, which also has to do with temperature, water temperatures in the Pacific, especially. And it's a shorter term cycle of about, it's a very loose cycle, about 3 to 12 years. How does the PDO, the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, and the AMO, the Atlantic Multidecadal Oscillation, do you have a sense of how these connect or correlate with El Nino Southern Oscillation dynamics?
Yeah, we do. There's a good record of that. And incidentally, any of your listeners can go online to the NOAA website, and you can get a global temperature image of the ocean water temperatures on a daily basis, taken from satellites. And what you will see on that is during a time of an El Nino. El Nino is a warm current that starts about is at the equator in South America, about off Peru or so, and it looks like a Geiger going across the Pacific Ocean, and the temperature is warmer, so on infrared it'll show up as an orange Geiger shaped figure going across the ocean. And it lasts usually about 2 years, something like that, and then the transition phase on either side, and then it's generally followed by La Nina, which is where we are right now. The El Nino of 2009-2010 is over, and it has now been replaced by a cold water system at the equator, following the same path. It starts in South America, off the coast of Peru, and now that warm current at the equator has been replaced by a cold current, and that's affecting our climates already, and it's going to give us another cold, snowy winter in the northern hemisphere land areas, almost certainly. It's setting up to be particularly strong this year. But at any rate, to answer your question, this is a short-term thing. Each one of these is about 2 years, three at the most, for both the El Nino warm current and the La Nina cold current. And what happens with respect to the PDO is that during the warm phase of the PDO, the warm El Ninos are favored, so there are more of them, and they're deeper, in other words, warmer. And then when the PDO, every 25 years or so, switches mode, say, into the cold mode, then there are more intense La Ninas, a cold period, than in the previous cycle. And so there's a direct relationship between the number and intensity of the warm and cold equatorial currents with respect to what the PDO is doing. Yes, they are related.
What about activity in the ocean vault that's volcanic? Does that have much of an influence?
It probably has almost none. You can't heat ocean water with volcanism, except extremely locally. We know this because you can look at submarine eruptions in various places of the world, and you look at the satellite photography, infrared photography of the water temperatures, and it's only warm in the immediate vicinity of the volcano and for a very, very localized area, and it doesn't really affect the nearby ocean temperatures at all. And in terms of atmospheric changes, if you get a really big ash eruption, like Pinatubo a couple of decades ago, then that puts a lot of stuff in the atmosphere, especially sulfur compounds and other things that tend to reflect a lot of energy coming from the sun. And so you get a global cooling for about 1 year or maybe 2 years before all this stuff settles out of the atmosphere. So the influence of volcanoes may be felt for a year, and then it's over, and then it's done. And so there's no protracted effect on climate by volcanic eruptions, only very short term.
Okay, so despite the fact that the media keeps telling us and the politicians keep telling us that it is warming and that it's our fault, in fact, if we look at the temperature data from satellites and as well as from instruments, we see that, as you mentioned, temperatures have been cooling off around the world, and in many cases, glaciers are starting to reflect that by advancing. In a sense, the politicians must be scrambling like crazy to maintain this illusion of warming, when in fact 2007, 2008 had very cold winters in which much of the warming that occurred between that warm phase, 1977 to 1999, was reversed. So could you tell us a little bit about what the glaciers are doing? There's all these hot-button propaganda, I would call them propaganda items that we hear. Sea levels are rising, glaciers are retreating, polar bears are dying, all this sequence of sound bites, which each of which I think is fairly easy to refute. But since glaciers are your specialty, can you tell us what the glaciers are doing around the world, Don?
Sure. And just a little history. During each of the warm-cool phases of the last century, the glaciers advanced during cold periods and retreated during warm periods. So we had glacial advances from 1880 to 1915, glacial retreat from 1915 to 1945, glacial advances from 45 to 77. Then glaciers had been retreating since about 1977 up until about 2000 or so. And it takes a little while for the glaciers to change gears, so it isn't instantaneous like it is in the ocean. It takes a little while for them to turn around. And so what's happening now is there are the glaciers, some glaciers in Alaska, I don't know about all of them, but some of them that I do know about stopped retreating a couple of years ago and have begun to advance. There have been glacial advances noted in Sweden and in Norway and in various other parts of the world. And as the Pacific Decadal Oscillation gets deeper into its cool mode, you can expect these glaciers and others, more glaciers, to stop retreating to begin advancing once again. And turning to the politicians for a moment, I have to chuckle periodically because the cooler it gets, the louder the politicians are shouting. And one of the things that they've been shouting is that the warmer it gets, the colder it's going to be. And they explain the really cold, record-setting, snowy winter that we had last year as being due to global warming. And if you can figure out the logic of that, let me know.
Yeah.
The other interesting thing is that sea levels are supposed to be rising, and they're going to be rising 20 feet. Al Gore has stated that by 2015, sea level is going to be 20 feet higher than it is now, and all the coastal cities are going to drown. In fact, sea levels are rising have been rising at a rate since we came out of the ice age about 500 years ago. They've been rising about a foot a century, something like that. Maximum expectable, even if global warming continued, which it isn't, would be something like a foot and a half. So there's no big sea level scare. And I was just reading today an article which was put out by NOAA, who's supposed to be the big climate experts, about how there's unequivocal evidence now that this is going to be the warmest year ever and that we're all going to have a terrible catastrophe. Sea levels are rising, and we know that because of measurements made by ships in the ocean. Can you imagine measuring sea level when you're floating in the ocean? I don't know how you do that. So anyway, there's a lot of nonsense going on, a lot of lies. You can believe almost nothing that's in the media because the mainstream media, the major television network stations and the major newspapers, with a couple of exceptions, have all bought into this dogma, this almost a religious belief, that no matter what the data says, you've got to believe in CO2 and all the terrible things that are going to happen. And as it continues to get cool, they seem to be ratcheting up the loudness with which they're shouting, and have no answer whatsoever from any of the evidence.
Yeah, there is a lot at stake, apparently, because there's a massive propaganda blitz that's been going on for a long time. But just to go back to your point about the fact that the apologists for the alarmists for man-caused global warming, there's actually an acronym in one of my recent book purchases here called HIGWIG, which stands for Human-Induced Global Warming-Induced Global Cooling. And this is the incredible the reversal of all logic, saying that the present global cooling is a result of global warming, and yet that is what the politicians and many scientists as well are telling us. Now we really, I guess, at some point we're going to have to look at why the science has been so corrupted as to have the so-called experts. Telling us that black is white and cold is warm, etc. But you've seen this over the years. You've gone to many conferences where I'm sure you must have felt like kind of the odd man out because you were not coming to the politically correct decision Do you perceive, can you just comment a little bit about how that has been for you? I know I've talked to some of my other colleagues who say, well, Don Easterbrook's been, you know, holding the, he's been trying to talk about these cycles in the face of even the scientific organizations being politicized.
That's true. And the bottom line of all this, it's all about power and money, both for the scientific people involved and for the politicians that are involved. And we can get back to the politicians and cap and trade and trillions of dollars that they're going to stick in their pockets a bit later, if you like. But as far as the scientists are concerned, if you look at what has transpired in the scientific world, for example, if you take, say, East Anglia scandal, where the data was doctored and there were emails about suppressing data and trying to keep any kind of global cooling from being published and taking over of the peer review mechanism so that they could control what gets published and what doesn't. It's all about money. And just to give you a few examples, Al Gore, for example, reportedly has made $100 million since he started his campaign, and he has several billion in his treasure chest, reportedly. There is the case of the East Anglia director, name is Phil Jones, who received $26 million in grant funds, pushing the CO2 thing. The chairman of the UN committee, the IPCC, Vachari, who's an Indian, has been spouting the demise of Himalayan glaciers, just as one example, going to make for extreme water shortages in Asia. And his basis for that was some pamphlets, some articles written by non-scientists in various activist organizations. And he used that to leverage money. He has apparently made millions of dollars. And he is also a shareholder in the Chicago Climate Exchange, apparently, reported on the Internet at least, where he stands to make perhaps billions of dollars if he can push cap and trade through the American legislature. So there is a huge profit motive for even the scientists. And in the United States, there is, I think, about $2.5 billion a year devoted to various kinds of climate research, all of which goes to the CO2 pushers. Somebody like me wouldn't stand a chance of getting it. And they've also taken over control of some of the principal journals. Nature is one, the American Geophysical Union, the Geological Society of America has just capitulated, and they have endorsed the CO2 thing. And as a matter of fact, the Geological Society of America has even gone so far as to suppress papers that have been submitted for publication and approved in advance on the basis that they do not comport to the consensus, so-called. In other words, they have data that is anti-CO2, and so they're refusing to publish those just because they don't have the right dogma message. And I know of five papers that have been rejected by the Geological Society of America simply on the basis that it isn't the same as the so-called consensus view, and therefore they're not going to publish, even though the data shows otherwise. The data is independent and unequivocal. So they are refusing, these scientific organizations, the American Geophysical Union and the Geological Society of America, are even refusing to publish articles from their own members with data relating to what's going on with the climate. So the bottom line and the answer to the question is, it's all about money and power.
Well, yes, and of course it must be extremely frustrating for you, as it has been for me as well, since your research completely refutes this modern myth of man-caused global warming. But going back to this kind of hijacking of our major, most prestigious scientific organizations, you mentioned the American Geophysical Union, the AGU, has a membership of about 50,000 researchers, teachers, and students in 137 countries. And they put out a statement in 2003 and then rewrote it and revised it, but essentially came out with the same statement in 2007. On human impacts on climate. Would you like me to read that? Because this is the consensus view,
sure,
which the data disproves. But this is what the AGU, this very prestigious group, says. The says, this is their statement, the Earth's climate is now clearly out of balance and is warming. Many components of the climate system, including the temperatures of the atmosphere, land and ocean, the extent of sea ice and mountain glaciers, the sea level, the distribution of precipitation, and the length of seasons are now changing at rates and in patterns that are not natural and are best explained by the increased atmospheric abundances of greenhouse gases and aerosols generated by human activity during the 20th century. Global average surface temperatures increased on average by about 0.6 degrees centigrade, that's about 1 degree Fahrenheit, over the period 1956 to 2006. As of 2006, 11 of the previous 12 years were warmer than any other since 1850. The observed rapid retreat of Arctic sea ice is expected to continue and lead to the disappearance of summertime ice within this century. Evidence from most oceans and all continents except Antarctica shows warming attributable to human activities. Recent changes in many physical and biological systems are linked with this regional climate change. A sustained research effort involving many AGU members and summarized in the 2007 assessments of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, that's the IPCC, continues to improve our scientific understanding of the climate. During recent millennia, a relatively stable climate civilization became established and populations have grown rapidly. In the next 50 years, even the lower limit of impending climate change, an additional global mean warming of 1 degree centigrade above the last decade, is far beyond the range of climate variability experienced during the past 1,000 years and poses global problems in planning for and adapting to it. Warming greater than 2 degrees centigrade above 19th century levels is projected to be disruptive, reducing global agricultural productivity, causing widespread loss of biodiversity, and if sustained over centuries, melting much of the Greenland ice sheet with ensuing rise in sea level of several meters. If this 2 degrees centigrade warming is to be avoided, then our net annual emissions of carbon dioxide must be reduced by more than 50% within this century. With such projections, there are many sources of scientific uncertainty, but none are known that could make the impact of climate change inconsequential. Given the uncertainty in climate projections, there can be surprises that may cause more dramatic disruptions than anticipated from the most probable model projections. With climate change, as with ozone depletion, the human footprint on Earth is apparent. The cause of disruptive climate change, unlike ozone depletion, is tied to energy use and runs through modern society. Solutions will necessarily involve all aspects of society. Mitigation strategies and adaptation responses will call for collaborations across science, technology, industry, and government. Members of the AGU, as part of the scientific community, collectively have special responsibilities to pursue research needed to understand it, to educate the public on the causes, risks, and hazards, and to communicate clearly and objectively with those who can implement policies to shape future climate. So this is a statement they made in 2007, revised in 2003, and then revised in 2007. And yet you find much to disagree with here, I'm sure, Don. Is that right?
Well, Eric, you're a scientist yourself. Have you ever read this scientific garbage in your life? Can you actually believe that these people who call themselves scientists, and especially Earth scientists, could actually say these things? Because they are so contrary to the facts. I mean, the data is there. The data speaks way louder than all that kind of rhetoric does. For example, it goes on and on about how there's unequivocal evidence of global warming and the retreat of glaciers and on and on. Well, yeah, so what? That doesn't improve with CO2. As a matter of fact, they totally ignore the fact that for 30 years after CO2 soared, we had global cooling, in which case you could make a case for, gee, CO2 causes global cooling, not global warming. If you use that as the basis, the only evidence that has been alluded to in the way of physical evidence for CO2 as a cause of global warming is the so-called hockey stick, the famous discredited hockey stick of Michael Mann at Penn State University, where he apparently manipulated the data to suppress the warming that occurred during the medieval warm period about 1,000 years ago, and got rid of the little ice age about 500 years ago, so that it looked like no climate change had occurred until CO2 started to go up. It's totally false. that's the only evidence. It's been totally discredited by analysis of the data and by about 2,000 papers that argue exactly to the contrary. And so the only basis that they have for making their predictions are climate models, which, as I mentioned earlier, have failed the 10-year test. They couldn't even predict the increase in temperature correctly for 10 years, much less 100 years, so why should we believe them? And there is no other evidence. And so in the view of the mountain of evidence, much of which is on my website, you can see it for yourself in the data and the graphs that are there, which includes a wide variety of sources, not just glaciers, but isotopes and all other kinds of data, that this statement by the AGU is absolute scientific garbage. That's the only way to describe it. There's no way to say it nicely. And these people who are putting out that kind of nonsense obviously have no understanding of the data and have totally ignored all data to the contrary.
So yeah, I think go ahead.
I'm just saying.
Yeah, it's really discouraging from a point of view of a scientist, because this is a very complicated topic, and there is a tendency on the part of the lay public to want to respect the experts, and especially they almost have to when it's a subject that is this complex. But in this case, the experts have, like yourself, have been marginalized, and other non-experts or those driven by a political agenda have been advanced as experts. Let's look at the hockey stick for a minute, which of course is a reference to a graph or a figure that was put together by a team of three scientists, Michael Mann, Ray Bradley, and I believe Owen Hughes, in 1998.
And Brifra's in there too.
What's that?
Brifra's in there too. Sorry.
Who was in there?
Briffa, B-R-I-F-F-A, was in on that too, just to add one more name to it.
Okay, yeah. Anyway, in 1998, this paper came out, I think in Nature, which is one of those journals that you said has been more or less hijacked, and they show a graph based on, I think, about 11 or 12 tree ring locations, selected, of course, because they proved the right thing. And they showed a graph of proxy temperatures or estimated temperatures for the past 1,000 years, and this graph shows essentially a straight line for most of the past 1,000 years, and then during the post-World War II modern warming, quote-unquote, the graph goes towards the sky, and then, of course, made it look a bit like a hockey stick, so that's why it's called the hockey stick graph. This was used in the 2001 assessment report of the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which, of course, is a United Nations body and a political body at that, as a way of showing that humans were causing huge magnitude of change to a system which had essentially been stable and constant for the last 1,000 years. And as you say, in order to get this statistical manipulation so that it looked like a hockey stick rather than a time series which has big bumps in it, including the medieval warm period and the little ice age, they had to do some pretty fancy statistics, which have been proven to have been manipulated in a fraudulent way, actually. And to come up with this conclusion, they had to ignore virtually all scientific research which had been done prior, which showed the striking influence of the medieval warm period, about 800 or 900 up to about 1250, and then the little ice age between about 1300 and 1850. In both the medieval warm period and the little ice age, temperatures were significantly higher than present and then significantly lower for the little ice age than present. So that has been thoroughly discredited, and yet Al Gore, of course, used that graph in his movie, An Inconvenient Truth, and it has taken on a life of its own, even though statisticians and the American Academy of Sciences have disproven it. So here's a classic example of science fraud, what has proven to be science fraud, being used as a data point, as you say. And other than that, and the computer projections, they've got nothing.
Right, and one of the interesting sidelights of the whole hockey stick argument, in addition to the fraudulent use of data by a number of people, is that when that first came out in the IPCC report before last, most geologists looked at it and said, that's really a stupid graph. There are roughly 3,000 papers that have been published in the scientific journals that demonstrate the medieval warm period and the Little Ice Age. And here's one paper based on a few Turings that's supposed to overturn all of those other 3,000 papers. They're chock full of evidence that, in fact, the medieval warm period is actually warmer than it is now. And, in fact, if you look at the isotope work in the Greenland ice core, you can show that for the past 10,000 years, for the first 7,000 of the past 10,000 years, the entire temperature for that whole period, not just the medieval warm period, was warmer than it is right now. In other words, the temperatures for 7,000 years have been warmer than they are right now, and it's only been in the last 3,000 years that it's cooled off a bit. But the sequel to that is that man was accused of fraud, and there was an investigative team at Penn State University which was supposed to investigate whether or not he had used fraudulent methods. And their conclusion was, because he was so successful in getting grants, that his conclusions couldn't possibly be wrong, and therefore they said there's no fraud here. And he was rewarded with a $1.8 million NSF grant from the new funds that are coming from the government to promote jobs. And so he was discredited and then rewarded with $1.8 million in research funds, not just his, but apparently as a team effort of some sort, and exonerated by his university, because how could he possibly be wrong if he gets so many grants? The whole thing is just ridiculous.
Don, have you run across those that have spoken out being penalized for speaking out, and that it affected their universities and the like?
Oh, if you've got an hour, I can tell you story after story after story. I've experienced it 5 times myself. The University of in Oregon, there was a climatologist who was a state climatologist, George Taylor, who was essentially fired for putting out statements that cast doubt on CO2. The same thing happened at University of Washington in the climatology, oceanography, meteorological group there. I know of cases where people who might have been co-authors on papers with me, which have just data, you know, it's not opinions or anything like that, just data about climate change, have had to decline to have their name on it because it would affect their position at the university in which they teach. And there have even been cases where faculty members at universities, where there's supposed to be freedom of speech, have been ordered not to talk about anything anti-CO2 in their classes. And they have actually had members of the faculty sit in on their classes to make sure they didn't say anything against CO2. You know, it's back to the dark ages. It's just incredible. I never thought I would see this happening in science. But the science of climatology is totally corrupted right now. And you keep hearing the idea that this is the consensus among all scientists, and it really isn't. Because of the people who are involved in the IPCC, of the final report, of about 35 people who wrote the final report, 27 were not scientists. The IPCC admits that 80% of its membership are non-scientists, and the chairman himself is not a scientist, the chairman of the IPCC, and yet there is on record a list of 31,000 scientists who all have degrees in sciences, one of the sciences, who have signed a statement saying that there is no evidence to believe that CO2 is causing climate change, and yet you never see reference made to those 31,000 scientists holding degrees in the sciences, including PhDs, to the contrary. You know, it's just absolutely absurd. I keep wondering, where did I fall in the rabbit hole and end up in Alice in Wonderland?
I completely agree. In fact, let me just mention, to kind of follow up on that question, Melody, there's a book by a former state climatologist from Virginia named Patrick J. Michaels called Climate of Extremes, Global Warming Science They Don't Want You to Know. And in his preface, he talks about how he was eased out of his position as state climatologist for political reasons. And he talks about these other state climatologists, such as George Taylor at Oregon State University, David Leggetts at the University of Delaware, was told by the governor that he could no longer speak on global warming as state climatologist. Assistant state climatologist for Washington, Mark Albright, was fired because, despite his boss's orders, he refused to stop emailing to journalists, to inquiring citizens, to anyone, the entire snowfall record for the Cascade Mountains, rather than the cherry-picked one, and on and on. I have several more examples that he gives in the preface of people who have sometimes lost their job because they were doing their job. So what we have is a very, very pervasive. Well, it's worse than what the Roman Catholic Church did to preserve the idea that the sun revolves around the earth, and when of course they put Galileo in prison and burned Bruno at the stake. It would seem now that the dominant institution of our time, the state, has taken on even a more ambitious program suppression of scientific information.
Do we have a climate?
That's
do we have a climate czar?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Do we have a climate czar?
Well, Eric Holdren is the science czar.
Okay, all right.
Oh yeah, right. We do, definitely. Okay. And we have a couple of czars. One is Sue HSU, and the other is Holden, I guess. And it's curious. I thought the best thing to say is that at least they haven't started burning people at the stake yet. Although James Hansen, who is the chief climatologist for NASA, has suggested that people who disagree with him be sent to prison for life for crimes against humanity, and that the skeptics, like me, should be shut up in some way and put away in a prison somewhere so that nobody can hear us. So there is very definitely a strong effort to suppress any dissenting data and or opinion. The data speaks for itself. And so what they're trying to do, of course, is to prevent any of the data from getting out, because then it's pretty obvious that what they're saying is nonsense.
Yeah. Don, I was the treasurer of the American Quaternary Association during the early 80s, and I recall a couple of meetings that occurred in 1986, I believe, the topic. It was in Boulder, Colorado, which has become one of the major areas. The NCAR, National Center for Atmospheric Research, has become kind of the American equivalent of the East Anglia research team over in England, which promotes the quote-unquote consensus view that humans are at fault and it's CO2. And then in 1988, the EMCA meeting was held in Flagstaff, and the keynote speaker, I think, was Stephen Schneider. In 1986, I think we were already starting to see almost a takeover of EMCA by the quote-unquote consensus politically correct scientists. Would you have any insights about that? I mean, to have Stephen Schneider, this biologist, who's of course always been an advocate of global warming, come and address AMCA seemed a little outrageous to me, since he had done virtually no research on climate change, other than
even models. More. Speaking of AMCA, even more ludicrous than that was the meeting in Montana, it's been 3 or 4 years now, I guess, where the invited speaker was Bill Ruderman, whose idea is that the cause of climate change is man, and that the ice age, where we have temperature changes of 15 degrees, sometimes in less than a century, was man-made, being caused by man-made fires. And that brought the ice age to a close, according to him, despite the fact that even with the the big increase in CO2, it still amounts to only 0.001%. And how much CO2 can the small, very small population of Neanderthal-type people, how much CO2 can they put in the atmosphere, which is virtually nothing added to nothing, which gives you nothing, and therefore couldn't possibly be related. And the interesting thing about bringing the Ice Age to a close and the whole Ruddiman nonsense is that we know from the ice core data that there were temperature changes, huge temperature changes, some of them amounting to right around 10 degrees or more, something like that, in about 40 years. At the end of the last ice age, there were tremendous temperature changes. And there were temperature changes of 15 degrees that occurred in about 100 years coming out of the last ice age, you know, which is way more than you could possibly get with any imaginable amount of CO2. And there was no change in CO2. CO2 was low at that time, and it didn't begin to rise until the end of the ice age, and the oceans warmed up and put a bunch more CO2 back in the atmosphere. So as soon as you start looking at the data, the whole thing just falls apart, and you think, my God, what kind of scientists are these who are either ignoring all this data or in some cases simply lying about it?
Just for our listeners who may be interested in following this argument with some figures, in Don's website there's an article called Lessons from Past Global Climates. And the top figure there is from the GISP2 ice core from the Greenland ice sheet, which gives a record of about the last 16,000 years. And in this record of temperature over the last 16,000 years, Don identifies seven intervals when there was a very, very rapid warming and a great warming, much, much greater magnitude than anything we saw in the last 1,000 years. And yet this, it doesn't seem to, the quote-unquote consensus group never refers to this kind of data. But for those who would like to look at this, he talks about, he just basically color codes the warm swings where the temperature rises dramatically in red and color codes the blue swings when the temperature drops dramatically, and identifies intervals about 15,000 years ago, and then 14,000, and then 13,400, and then 13,200, and then 12,700 years ago, and then finally 11,500 years ago, when the global temperatures rose very sharply. And so, you know, this is the basic data, which is unfortunately being ignored, in a sense, a little bit like the book 1984, where you erase the past.
Let me go ahead and say you're listening to Truth Quest with Melody on KHEN LPFM Radio 106.9 Salida, Colorado. We're streamed on the internet at khen.org, and Truth Quest programs are archived at www.gimmesometruth.info. And my co-host this evening is Dr. Eric Carlstrom, and he will post this interview and information about it at www.naturalclimatechange.us. And our guest, Don Easterbrook, his website is myweb.ww.edu/dbunny/research/global/index.htm, but you can probably just get a hold of him at Don Easterbrook if you just Google his name. So
that's
ahead.
A lot easier.
Yes.
Yeah, so Don, did you want to make a comment about those rapid warmings that we see in the GISP2 ice core data? This is a time series of about the last 16,000 years.
Yeah, they're interesting. For anybody who wants to go to the website and look it up, it's figure 13, and it is on page 9 of the article, which it talks about all of these things. It's a fairly long paper. And on it is a curve which was based on oxygen isotope data and temperature data of the GISP2. This is the Greenland ice core that went down all the way to bedrock. And it shows rather dramatically that there were temperature increases in a century of 10 to 15 degrees, and we're talking about 1 degree in the last century, and here we're talking about 15 or 20 degrees in one century. If you look at the magnitude and the rate of increase during at the end of the last ice age, both up and down, both warming and cooling, and look at the present one at the far right of that curve is just a little tiny blip. And so the ratio is about a millimeter high for the present global warming and probably about an inch and a half, 2 inches for the warming and cooling took place about 10 to 15,000 years ago. The other interesting thing on that graph is I've drawn a straight line from the present temperature all the way through that graph, and for the period from 10,000 years ago to 3,000 years ago, a period of 7,000 years, the temperature is substantially warmer than it is right now. So this warming that we have right now is nothing new, and it's actually trivial compared to what we've seen in the past. And during this whole period that we're talking about, there can have been no influence of CO2 because CO2 levels were actually considerably lower than they are now. And that we always find that the ratio of the relative level of CO2 to global climate when we're coming in and out of some warming and cooling periods of this magnitude is that the CO2 increase that does occur when the climate warms is about 800 years after the climate starts to warm. So the CO2 isn't causing the warming. The warming is causing the CO2 rise because ocean water temperature dictates how much CO2 goes into the atmosphere, and there's way, way more CO2 in the oceans than there is in the atmosphere. So that graph is interesting because it shows the huge temperature swings that occurred 10,000 years ago without any possible influence of CO2, and not just once, but there are about, on this particular graph at least, six or seven major temperature changes over a period of a few thousand years. And the other thing is that most of the last 10,000 years has been warmer than present. So if you're worried about the polar bears, forget it. They survived 7,000 years of warmer than it is now, and are doing just fine.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit about climate cycles. Now, the computer models which have been generated at various research stations pretty much say that the climate is not cyclical. This is the assumption that they make. Since the cycles are complex, they find it easier to just ignore them and attribute climate change to changes in CO2. So the assumptions then determine what conclusions you have. And there's a phrase for that in computerese called the GIGO, garbage in, garbage out. If your assumptions are bad, your conclusions have to be bad. But let's, as a geologist, I'm sure you have a sense of not only short-term cycles, like your 25 to 30-year cycle, which related to the PDO, but also some longer-term cycles. How many cycles would you think would need to be realistically accounted for to start to understand the climate system?
Well, you can get a really good idea of the variability of climate just by looking at the last 20,000 years. And the whole ice age, glacial, interglacial oscillation goes back about 2 million years. And so there have been a number of ice ages and interglacial warming periods that were warmer than they are now. So this has been going on for a long time, and it's nothing new at all. If there's nothing unusual at all about climate warming, and certainly for all of these, there's absolutely no way that you could attribute them to CO2 because CO2 did not vary. And as a matter of fact, looking just at the last big climate shift, which occurred in 1977, if you plot the CO2 changes across that climate change where we switched abruptly from global cooling to global warming, there's absolutely no change in CO2 across that border. And if you plot CO2 versus global temperature for the past century, there's no correlation at all. The two curves intersect each other several times and cut across one another. And if you plot solar variation, it plots exactly with the temperature change over the last century. So there is a lot of data that shows quite clearly what's going on. And to answer your question, I think we can probably learn the most from the last glacial interglacial phase, that is the last 20,000 years, because there we have the most detailed record, geologic record, and we can tell more about what actually went on. And the farther back we go, we still have these kinds of changes, but the level of detail gets blurred a little bit the farther back you go.
Yeah, certainly we have identified some solar cycles, the 11-year cycle, the 22-year sunspot cycles. We also have longer solar cycles, the Gleisberg cycle of about 90 years, and also longer cycles. These are important to look at since we know that the climate system is 99.9% driven by the sun, and the sun is the energy system for what goes on with the climate system, the hydrologic cycle, clouds. It is our energy source, and so very, very tiny changes in solar activity, such as sunspots or magnetic intensity, could be expected to cause quick and rapid shifts in our temperature and in our precipitation, et cetera. So what is going on with the sun then to give us, you think, these 25, 30-year cycles of the PDO and the AMO?
Well, we don't really know yet enough detail about the physics of what's going on in the interior of the sun to fully understand why the sun is doing what it is. What's very clear is that there's a very nice correlation between what the sun is doing and what the Earth's climate is doing. And if you just want to look at some examples, then we'll talk about what we're in right now. But if you go back to a time when the Little Ice Age first began, which would be sometime after about 1300, and from then, if we jump up to about 1600, there was a time of low solar output called the Maunder Minimum. And that was the height of the Little Ice Age, when climates got really cool. And for a period of 50 years, there were virtually no sunspots. And a third of the population of Europe was decimated by famine and disease as a result of crop failures and disease and that sort of thing. And so I went back and I plotted the solar irradiance values for the last 500 years, and looking at the relationship between solar minimums and Earth's climate, there's a one-to-one correlation. When the sun's output is less, the Earth's climate is colder, surprise, surprise. And for the last five major cold periods, during the last 500 years, there's a one-to-one correlation, including the 1945 to 1977 cooling. There was a dip there. And the one before that was the 1880-1915 glacial advance and global cooling, which corresponds also to a solar low. Before that, the Dalton Minimum from 1790 to about 1820 was another cold period, which is where we seem to be headed right now. And then before that, about 1600 to 1700, the Maunder Minimum, and there's an earlier one before that that goes back to about 1500. But to get to what the sun is doing right now, we have just come out of what's called a grand maximum solar cycle and just entered a grand minimum solar cycle. And so the solar physicists are saying, okay, look out, and they're plotting magnetic indexes, which are low and staying abnormally low. The sunspot cycle is also very, very low and has been elongated. And the last time this happened was in about 1790, roughly 1800. And at that time, we had the same kind of solar phenomenon going on that we see today. And the result of that was that they had a very cold period. This was a time when Napoleon's army was decimated by a terrible winter in Russia as part of this really deep cold period, and other historic events of a similar nature. So we have a history of this. And the solar physicists now, the folks that I work with, are saying, look out, because when you compare the details of what's going on in the sun now, with the details of what was going on with the sun in about 1800, it looks like we're well on our way to the same thing that happened during the Dalton Minimum about 800 years ago when it was really cold. The bottom line is that the sun is saying we're in for several decades of perhaps deep global cooling. The ocean is telling us the same thing. The global temperatures are telling us the same thing. We've not exceeded the 1998 global temperature, which was the second warmest. And the temperature trend for the last 12 years is down, not up, no matter how you cut it. The temperature trend for that 12-year period is not positive. It's negative. It's going down. And so in terms of prediction, if you plug all this information then into the pattern of cycles that I calculated from the isotope data in the Greenland ice core, we're right where we ought to be. We ought to be changing from a warm cycle to a cool cycle in about the year 2000, which we did, and it's happening right now. And it looks now like the PDO, the Pacific Cold Temperature water temperature, is intensifying, and global ocean temperatures are plunging right now. So all of this adds up to, it looks like we're in for global cooling. And before we say, oh, thank goodness, we don't have to worry about global warming, we don't dare do that because global cooling is way worse than global warming. Global cooling kills more people than global warming, a ratio of at least 2-1, something like that. And if you think about what global cooling does, it cuts down crop production, cuts down food supply, increases per capita energy demand. And while all of this is going on, we're going to be experiencing a 50% increase in global population in the next 40 years, and then double again after that. So we're going to have this hugely escalating demand for food and energy at a time when both of those are going to be declining. So it's not a pretty picture, and we ought to be worrying about global cooling, not about global warming.
And yet our politicians, if you look at the phase two of the Kyoto Protocol or the roughly equivalent Global Warming Solutions Act of 2006 passed by the governor of California, Schwarzenegger, These long-range programs call for reducing our use of fossil fuels down, by 70 or 80% below 1990 levels. So at the same time when it could well be getting colder and we need more energy, they're calling for a virtual phase-out of fossil fuel energy as the underpinnings of civilization. Well, let me just say that 85% at least of all the energy that we use in the world is fossil fuel energy, and that's coal, gas, and oil. And if we phase that back, we're essentially going to roll back civilization dramatically unless we come up with some equivalent energy source, and there is none except for possibly nuclear, and they would have to start building nuclear plants at the rate of one a day to catch up. What do you say about that, Don?
Well, there are two interesting aspects to that, neither one of which is particularly good in terms of the human population. The energy that is being used right now, as you point out correctly, it's mostly from fossil fuels, about 85%. You can't replace that with solar and wind anytime soon. If you did it, the entire surface of the earth would be covered with windmills and solar panels. There wouldn't be room for anybody else. But the interesting part about that whole energy problem is that as the demand goes up and the availability goes down, it's going to cause a lot of problems. And those problems carry with it a very severe penalty, because the people who are going to pay the most dearly for that are going to be people in third world countries. And there are estimates out now all over the place, but for a global cooling such as we are apparently headed for, it's probably going to cost several million lives of people in third world countries on the verge of starvation right now, and which will probably not make it when the food supply is diminished. And the other interesting part of this whole thing is, let's suppose for a moment that these laws are enacted. That what it means is that we would go back to the output of CO2 into the atmosphere from energy sources back to something like 1850. Can you imagine modern-day society getting by on the energy that was consumed in 1850? You know, it essentially would reduce the whole world to third world status. And the amount of energy that's being consumed is probably going to go up, not go down. And then you ask the ancillary question, what effect would there be if we totally shut down all carbon emissions and we stop everything except heavy breathing and no CO2 is going to go into the atmosphere beyond what's there right now? How would that affect the climate? And the answer is not at all. The maximum change that you could get, and this is the physics of it, with a doubling of the CO2 in the atmosphere right now is about one-tenth of a degree. Not 10 degrees, one-tenth of 1 degree. If you double what we have right now, well, let's suppose that we don't double it. Let's suppose that we go back to 1850 levels. What's that going to do to the CO2 in the atmosphere? And what's that going to do to climate? Well, you need to realize that there is so little CO2 in the atmosphere. There's 38/1,000 of 1% CO2 in the atmosphere right now, even with these high levels. The total change in the composition of the atmosphere since 1945, when CO2 started to go up rapidly, is 8/1,000 of 1%. So how much climate change is that going to affect? Well, if you look at the effectiveness of CO2 as a greenhouse gas, it's only 3.5% of the total greenhouse effect. 95% is water vapor. And water vapor is not changing. And so you can't say, well, CO2 is going to change the temperature a little bit, and that's going to increase the water vapor, and that's going to make a big change. That whole argument is totally specious, totally wrong, because all the evidence we have now is that, if anything, water vapor is actually, the content of the atmosphere has actually gone down a little bit, not up. And it's certainly not showing any kind of trend in concert with CO2. So CO2 by itself cannot change the climate. There's no doubt about that whatsoever. And if you want to reduce the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere, it would probably take something like several hundred years, even if we reduce the output, emission output right now to zero, it would take 700 years before you'd notice any difference in the composition of the atmosphere anyway, because it's all governed by the equilibrium between the atmosphere and the oceans. And so the whole CO2 argument is is frankly a really dumb one.
Can I ask a question? I just was wondering, I hear that there's less oxygen in the atmosphere. Is that true, and is there a relationship?
No, I don't think so. I don't know of any evidence that suggests there's less atmospheric oxygen now than before. The total composition of the atmosphere, of course, is mostly nitrogen. It's about 80% nitrogen. There's about roughly 20% oxygen, and then a minuscule amount of CO2. And the amount of oxygen in the atmosphere, as far as I know, has not changed significantly. And there's a lot of it. There's 20%. So, you know, it would take a huge change before it would have any effect. So I think the answer to your question is no. I don't think that's a factor.
Okay.
Well, it just for the benefit of our listeners, and I know this is well known, I think, to both you and Don and Melody, but the CO2 is a miracle gas. It's the basis of photosynthesis, which of course is the basis of all terrestrial life. And as we learned in our interviews with Dr. Timothy Ball, for most of the Earth's history, the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere has been significantly higher than now. Maybe in many cases, in 80% of the world's climate has also been warmer. But this is as you say, warmer temperatures mean more CO2. So that the dinosaurs would have lived in a time when there was much more CO2, and of course, more CO2 means more plant growth. And you double or triple or quadruple the CO2 content of the Earth's atmosphere. And it would only have positive effects on the amount of plant growth. It would not hurt animal life. So the idea that somehow CO2 is a pollutant which needs to be regulated, which now is reinforced by a Supreme Court decision in 2007. This is completely erroneous. What CO2 is, of course, is the basis of life. And if a government could regulate this, not only would they be regulating the energy use of a society, because CO2 is produced by burning fossil fuels, it would also have the opportunity to regulate life itself. Could even tax human beings for the CO2 that we exhale, etc.
One other question. I was wondering, is there a relationship with the drought conditions that they're talking about in with water in all of this?
There is. There's no doubt that drought is occasioned by climate. And when it's warm and dry, then and lack of water, that can go on for anywhere from a few years to a few decades, and it can have very devastating effects if you're trying to grow crops without water. And there are places in the world where there have been droughts going on for some time. In general, there probably is a correlation between droughts and warm climates. Warm climates, in most cases, would probably be more likely to cause droughts than during times of a cooler climate when there may be more precipitation. So yes, there is a connection, but droughts are kind of ephemeral things, and they tend to be regional. So there can be droughts going on, for example, in Africa, Australia, and various places. And they can persist from a warm period into a cool period or vice versa, because it sometimes takes a while to turn the whole system around on a regional basis. But yes, there's a correlation, but it's really hard to predict.
Have you seen any relationship then with them trying to draw this into the global warming argument?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, what you'll hear almost on a daily basis from the people who are pushing CO2 is that what we're looking forward to is catastrophic changes in food production because of droughts, which are going to be brought about by global warming. And the hotter it gets, the more drought there's going to be, and the less food there's going to be, and so on. So, yes, they're definitely using it a lot.
Well, one aspect that we've kind of touched on but haven't really delved into is the work that's been done by Svensmark and others in Denmark, which would suggest a mechanism by which variations in solar magnetic intensity or solar variability would translate to the amount of cloudiness on the Earth, and therefore to the average temperature and the amount of precipitation. Are you impressed with this research, Don, that shows a possible mechanism or linkage between variations in solar magnetic intensity and temperature?
Oh yeah, I talked with Svensmark in Oslo about a year ago. And he was at that time formulating his whole idea of how this process might work. And essentially, what it does is that the sun's magnetic field, which is very expansive and protects the Earth a lot, it's like a great shield to protect us from radiation from space. And the sun's magnetic field diminishes in strength and extent significantly. It's been diminishing for some years right now. The last 17 years have been going down dramatically, and it's now approaching a very low amount. And so what that does is it allows a lot more radiation into the upper atmosphere. That radiation then ionizes atoms in the upper atmosphere. To ionize something means that you give it a electrical charge, and that facilitates the condensation of moisture about these ions and produces clouds. And the more clouds you have, the more reflection of solar energy you have, and the cooler it gets. So this would produce cooling, and it seems he's produced this experimentally, and it also seems to be holding up with respect to observations that can be made with cloudiness generally on the Earth. So yes, I'm enthused about the possibilities that Svensmark's idea has, And there needs to be a lot more work done on it. This is again one of those areas where, you know, we could certainly use a lot more money for research instead of fooling around with other stuff. The National Academy of Sciences recently spent $8 million putting out a propaganda brochure, essentially, with no real data in it, that could have been used for this kind of research. So there's a lot of money being wasted and a lot of possibilities being overlooked because of the absence of the funding for this, because it doesn't support CO2.
Don?
Yeah.
One other question I had.
If I could follow up with that one, right. Melody. It's a number of the people who've written books about this issue and who are so-called skeptics have pointed out that the climate modelers, and there's a number of these groups that are modeling climate. East Anglia is one, and the Met office in London, and a number of them around the world, that they don't understand the water cycle. They don't understand, and of course you said 95% of the greenhouse effect is due to water vapor, and yet the water cycle is more or less completely ignored in the models. And what the Svensmark's data and research suggests is that the amount of clouds that we see covering the Earth will vary over decadal time spans, and that this may be directly related to variations in sunspot numbers. And in general, when you have low sunspot numbers like the Maunder minimum and the Dalton minimum, you have less solar magnetic intensity. Therefore, you get more cosmic radiation coming in from space. This cosmic radiation, which then can form the condensation nuclei around which water vapor condenses to form clouds. So the less magnetic intensity you have, the more clouds you have, the cooler the climate. The greater the magnetic intensity you have, the less clouds, and the warmer the climate. So this could be a direct link then between sunspots and their cycles and temperature and cloudiness here on the Earth.
That's certainly true, and there's an interesting corollary to that. If you think for a minute, well, is there some way then that this would leave a fingerprint on the Earth in some fashion that we could read back into the past to see if indeed this has been happening in the past? And the answer is yes, there is, because radiation in the upper atmosphere produces two isotopes of great importance. One is radiocarbon, carbon-14, which is what we use for a dating mechanism, actually. But the higher the radiation flux, more carbon-14 is produced in the upper atmosphere. The second is beryllium-10, which is an isotope of beryllium that's produced in the upper atmosphere by radiation involving a nuclear reaction with oxygen. But anyway, these two isotopes, then the abundance of these two isotopes is a measure of the amount of radiation in the upper atmosphere. Well, we can measure these in the ice cores. We can measure the CO2 content and the radiocarbon content in gases in the ice cores. We can also measure it in various organic substances. And in the ice cores, we could also measure beryllium-10. And what we find is that during the periods of maximum cold, these correspond to periods of greater production rates of these isotopes. And so there is at least a possibility of doing some really good research in further understanding this whole process by making these measurements from ancient footprints, if you like, of the cosmic radiation.
Can I throw in another little twist to this? Eric and I interviewed Rosalind Peterson, and she got into discussing that there's various departments of weather modification. And would weather modification play a role in any of this?
Well, by modification, you mean doing something to try to change the weather?
Right, or control it in some form or fashion.
Go ahead.
Oh, well, there was a proposal in Australia to eject into the atmosphere millions of tons of sulfur the idea that this would produce a warming effect, I mean a cooling effect, sorry, and slow down the ravages of the global warming that they were predicting. And there have been other suggestions of coating the oceans with various vessels that were going to spray water vapor into the air and do all kinds of these incredibly expensive, incredibly stupid things. And if you look at the one of the principal promoters of the whole CO2 concept and the we're all going to turn it into toast, which is James Hansen, the chief climatologist at NASA, back in the 1970s, his computer models were predicting global cooling. And they were trying to think of, well, how can we prevent global cooling? And the idea then was, maybe what they would do would be to coat glaciers with coal dust to increase the absorption of solar energy and a bunch of stuff like that. The bottom line is that the whole global climate system, the oceans and the atmosphere, the energy and the whole system is so enormous that any man-made effect is undoubtedly going to be trivial. And that includes CO2.
And yet we have Eric Holdren, the science czar, and others saying the Obama administration takes this threat of global warming so seriously that we need to look at various geoengineering schemes to combat it, right? So this has been said, I think, in February of 2010. So apparently the global warming scare then is being used or may be used to promote some geoengineering solutions.
I'm sure that there are a bunch of them out there, and some of them are actually laughable. They're so absurd, and they would have so little effect, and they would be so transitory that it wouldn't last any very long, and they wouldn't make any difference in the long run anyway. The bottom line is that man would like to think that man, meaning all humans, are an important factor in what goes on the earth, and that we hold our fate in our hands and that sort of thing. The truth is, Mother Nature does what it's going to do regardless of what humans are doing and the possible impact of what humans do, except on a local regional scale environmental thing. That's a different story. But in terms of global energy, global climate changes, the impact of man is very trivial.
Yeah, and just to kind of underscore that point, Dr. Reed Bryson, who is considered the father of modern scientific climatology, actually made a rather quotable statement. He said, "You can go outside and spit and have just as much effect on global warming as a doubling of carbon dioxide." You know,
so, I think he's probably right. Yeah, he was an outspoken fellow. He's now not with us anymore, but I think you got it right.
Yeah, and he says basically we're still warming from the little ice age. You know, he said that several years ago. So I think the people who really understand climate have looked at this whole issue of man-caused global warming very skeptically, and so skeptically that sometimes they have to be fired or marginalized. So we're dealing with a tremendous propaganda push, and you give us the main goals of politics and power. Could you elaborate a little bit? What's the agenda behind the fraudulent IPCC push to equate catastrophic warming with human activities?
Sure, it's definitely about power and money, and just consider a few factors that will make this very apparent. One is the whole idea of cap and trade. The idea is that the government will assign certain levels beyond which any industry that puts more CO2 in the atmosphere than they are allotted will have to pay for what are called carbon credits, which they buy on a carbon exchange. And those credits are generated by industries that are using less carbon than they would be allotted by the government. And so essentially CO2 would be traded like a stock in air, if you like, CO2. And so what would happen would be that people who are in on these climate exchanges, where it's like a stock exchange, you know, they're called climate exchanges, and So a big company would pay a lot of money to buy the carbon credits to stay in business. And where would that money come from? Well, it comes from our pocketbooks. So they would just pass the charge on to the public in terms of greater energy costs. As Obama himself has said, the price of electricity would skyrocket immediately if this were put into play. But the question is, then, where does the money go? Well, the money would go, the big money would be in the people who have the interest in the climate exchanges. And that includes Al Gore and the chairman of the IPCC, who is Pachauri, who is on the board, actually, of the Chicago Climate Exchange. The group that set up the Chicago Climate Exchange was a group on which Obama was a member of the board, interestingly enough. And so the money that would be available through this whole climate exchange process would amount to something like $800 billion in the first 4 or 5 years, about $200 billion a year have been some estimates. I'm not sure anybody really knows, but those are numbers that are being tossed around. And so over a 10-year period, you were talking about $1 trillion at least, and some people are saying, well, it's going to be way more than that, actually. And guess where that money comes from? It comes from the taxpayers or the consumers' pocketbooks, because they're the ones that are going to be paying the companies who are providing the energy, and the cost to them is going to be directly related to how much they have to pay for carbon credits. So having said all that, then the profiteers, as I call them, would be pocketing billions of dollars in personal fortunes, the people who have interest in the climate exchanges in particular. And so they are in line to make billions of dollars. So you have to ask the question, do they really care what causes climate change if they're going to make $1 billion pushing what they're pushing? And the answer is probably no, because they're greedy. The politicians get into this because there are huge lobbying efforts going on now to lobby politicians to vote for the cap and trade. Well, how do they lobby? Well, they put a few million dollars into campaign contributions and that sort of thing. They're essentially buying the politicians. And the politicians are happy to take their money and pass a bill that allows the lobbyists and the profiteers to make billions of dollars, which they can recycle a small amount back through the politicians. And guess what? You know, they make huge, huge fortunes. So there's big, big bucks involved in this for them. And I've already talked about what's in it for the scientists. You know, they get funding for their research projects and in the case of Pachauri, apparently personal fortunes made on it. So it's about money, really big money, that's driving this whole thing. And I believe now it's gone beyond any interest in science. They just don't care. It's all political. And if they can push this agenda, they will become incredibly rich. So again, back to my original statement, it's about power and money. Sidelight. One last thought about that. Pachauri, the chairman of the IPC, and others in the IPC and certain others of the CO2 pushers have suggested that every individual in the United States and the world actually be given essentially a carbon ration. You can only generate so much carbon a year, which would dictate what kind of car you would have, what kind of house you have, all kinds of things. It would be incredibly controlling, down to almost the amount of air you breathe. The chairman of the IPCC has even suggested that they would regulate the amount of ice that you could put in water glasses in restaurants, because it takes energy to make ice and that produces CO2. I mean, it's that ludicrous. And they're suggesting that there be huge taxes, tariffs be placed on airlines to try to inhibit people from traveling, and the same with hotels, to try to discourage people from traveling. They've even been talking about having toll booths along the highway and putting a device on your car to monitor how many miles you drive, so you would be rationed the total number of miles you could drive because it would use up your carbon credits. Yeah, but these whole things involve also a huge amount of control in addition to the amount of money, governmental control, in addition to the profits being made.
So it starts to look like a totalitarian system. Perhaps, Now, can you give us an idea? I know that this energy bill of Obama's has been trying to work its way through the Senate this summer. It seems to be kind of stalled out. Could you give us a little bit of an update as to what the prognosis is for this cap-and-trade idea being passed into a national energy bill?
Well, all I know is essentially what I read and hear, and the news on the news media is that Harry Reid has taken the cap-and-trade bill off the agenda for consideration by the Senate prior to the November election, and that they will try in the meantime to put through some kind of an energy bill. And the energy bill would be something that would be presumably fairly innocuous to say, well, we want to encourage solar and wind, and we want to put restrictions on deep ocean drilling for possible disasters and that kind of thing. A bill sounds kind of good, so if you voted against it, you'd be seemingly voting against something that sounds fairly reasonable. And then Harry Waxman, who's the chairman of the you know, the committee in the House that passed the House version of this, which has a cap and trade part to it, has said apparently to the news media that their hope is to get some kind of a climate energy bill through the Senate that would then go to the House committee that brings the Senate and the House bills together, at which point he will cram into it a cap and trade portion of it. So we get it by midnight candlelight and behind closed doors. The other thing that's being tossed about now is the Democrats are talking about not trying to do anything before the midterm elections because it's such an explosive thing. Because only about 30% of the American public now believes that man-made CO2 emissions are a problem and that needs fixing. It's at the bottom of a list of priorities of almost any list you can make. And so what they're saying is we'll wait till after the November elections, and then if the Democrats lose their majority, they will still have a lame duck session between then and the time the new elected officials take office in January, that they can pass anything they want because they still have a majority, and in which case if various politicians have been voted out of office, they don't care how they vote, because they have nothing to lose. They've already lost. And so the second line of attack is the idea that they will push something through in the lame duck session that they couldn't get pushed through now just because at that point it won't matter because elections have already happened. And the third part of this is that none of that takes place. The Environmental Protection Agency is taking upon itself the idea that it has the legal ability to regulate all CO2 emissions. Everything down to the air that you breathe is under their purview, and they can do whatever they want. They become a totally dictatorial organization, and they can say, because the Supreme Court has said we have the ability to regulate CO2 emissions, we can control how many miles you drive your car, so anything. And so the Obama administration is apparently saying, well, you better pass cap and trade, because if the EPA does it, they can do some really harsh things, and you don't want that, so you better pass cap and trade. So there's a lot of politics going on, and even though it's now off the table, I would look for a certain amount of late night, midnight, behind closed doors dealing going on to try to cram something through.
You gentlemen, I have to wonder. I mean, it's almost like this obfuscation and confusion as to who's dealing with all these issues. Is our Congress, or is it these non-governmental entities, or other types of organizations that are commercial related, having as much or more to do with this?
Well, there is also a component of industry, if you like, behind it. For example, the whole idea was originally came from Enron, believe it or not, this whole cap and trade idea, and they came up with the idea this would be a great way to make a lot of money. And there are big organizations now that are lobbying heavily for cap and trade because they would invest heavily in it and they would make billions of dollars. And you can read these on the Internet. The ones that I have read, and I don't know anything other than what I've read on the Internet, But the ones that were mentioned were firms like Goldman Sachs, Fannie Mae, well, there are some others. Anyway, there are some big corporations that are also behind us, and including some oil companies, because they could make a lot of money off it themselves. So it's kind of a catch-22 sort of thing, in that the very industries in some cases that would be hurt most by legislation are the ones that are pushing it, because they could being in the right spot and make a lot of money off it.
Yeah, and in relation to that, you know, there are some congressmen who are really trying to find the truth on this, and Republican Senator from Oklahoma, James Inhofe, has been very active in this. In fact, he's on the U.S. Senate Committee on Environment and Public Works, and he's held a number of hearings, and he's tried to solicit comments and information from people like Don Easterbrook, and tried to get the truth out. So as it's playing out, the Republican Party then has become the group that is opposing cap and trade. The Democrats are the ones that are trying to promote it and make it happen, which is an interesting dynamic in and of itself. Do you have any observations on what's behind that dynamic, Don?
Well, it's really sad to see that the politics getting involved in the science, because the science should stand on its own feet, its own evidence, and be independent. And of course, what has happened is the Democrats totally refuse to consider any of the information data that suggests that CO2 is not a problem, and the Republicans are on the other side. And so it's almost like, gee, if you're skeptical about CO2, you must be a Republican. Or vice versa. Well, I'm not. I'm a Republican. Matter of fact, I hate both parties with equal intensity. I don't like either one of them. And so it gets to be so political that pretty soon you find that most of the discussion is between politicians and arguing the politics of it, rather than scientists having an intellectual discourse about the pros and cons of what's going on. In other words, we're getting away from the science and getting bogged down in the politics of it.
Yeah, and so we're fortunately we still have public radio to make these conversations. But I think it's your point is well taken, even to the extent that, and I still teach at a university, that the textbooks themselves commonly come out with this mainstream consensus view that it is CO2 and that humans are causing the warming. So a young assistant professor just starting out, you know, maybe who got his PhD in something, you know, not very related to this, would teach out of the textbook, and therefore it becomes the conven that that humans are causing global warming.
Well, it's even worse than that, because there is a concerted effort going on to get this into textbooks for public schools, not just university, public schools, high schools, whatever. That push is to get people indoctrinated early on, so that they, you know, they build a base of young people coming up who just sort of assume that, you know, this is the way it is, and therefore they already have the minds of the younger generation on their side as they're coming up. And in England, as you know, there was a lawsuit that was brought which challenged the British school system, which was going to show the Gore movie, Inconvenient Truths, to all of the school children as if it were the gospel truth. And they pointed out a whole bunch of false things that were in that movie. And a judge ruled in their favor, said, yeah, these things are not true that are in the movie, and therefore, if you're going to show this movie to students, you're going to have to show the other side too, which put a bit of a kibosh on that. But that's that same sort of thing is happening in the U.S., I think. I don't know to what extent, but I've read stories here and there about the battles that are going on to get this stuff into textbooks and public schools, also at the university level.
Yeah. Well, fortunately now there are many, many DVDs, movies that have come out, such as The Great Global Warming Swindle and The Greenhouse Conspiracy and things like that, which give the other side, which is that this is mostly propaganda and not science. And there are also many, many good books that have been written by very, you know, concerned, credible people. And I'll just quote a couple of them here. One that I'm going to be using in my climatology class next fall is Heaven and Earth, Global Warming, The Missing Science by Professor Ian Plimmer of the School of Earth and Environmental Sciences, University of Adelaide. And he references something like 2,400 scholarly papers. So the overwhelming scientific evidence is that humans aren't doing much to change the climate at all, and there are people like Plimmer that have come out with textbooks which give the real story. Your website gives the real story, and so I see some hope in all of this, that underneath this big propaganda push, where there is a segment of society which is moving towards a greater understanding of the climate system than ever before, and yet we're faced with these zealots and ideologues. Plimmer himself says the idea of modern man-made global warming is in effect an urban atheistic religion. It's a matter of faith. It's got nothing to do with science.
That's true. It's another really good book that's just out fairly recently, which has a very nice explanation at the layman level of how the whole the sort of the physics of the atmosphere system works, and some of the arguments have been put out by IPCC and others, is by Roy Spencer, who is the guy that does all of the satellite readings. He and John Christie in Alabama are the ones that put out the temperature charts for the globe based on the satellite. He was involved in the early establishment of the instrumentation of the satellites, and now does a data reduction for it. But he has a new book out, which is, I forget the title of it offhand, but Roy Spencer is his name, and it's a really good explanation of what's really going on in the atmosphere.
I actually have that in front of me here, Don. It's called The Bad Science and Bad Policy of Obama's Global Warming Agenda. And it's quite short. It's only like 40-50 pages, 37-38 pages. And yeah, he's a climatologist by training, and he's watched the whole thing happen. He's got another book called Climate Confusion. So yeah, there are many, many sources now that a rational, educated, thinking person can go to. But again, we're swimming against an enormous tide because the media itself and the politicians are giving us a constant barrage of propaganda. So it's going to require that a large number of people think critically and get informed about a very complicated subject. The information's out there if people are willing to do the reading. And I guess that's my question now to you. Do you see the tide turning? Do you see the public becoming well enough educated that this climate bill won't be able to be passed?
Well, I think that there is a really strong tide now that has begun to turn in the general public against the whole idea of a man-caused global warming. And I don't attribute it necessarily to a big increase in the general public reading about it in books so much as the whole ClimateGate scandal in East Anglia really cracked the whole thing open and showed the fraud and the deception and the manipulation that's been going on with all the data and the lies that have been told. And I think that's had a bigger effect than probably most anything. And then lately, there's been data that has come out that showed that both NOAA and NASA are manipulating data in much the same way that the Hadley Group was. Not quite so blatantly fraudulent, but certainly manipulating it, and there are various ways that they do this, and you can actually trace the change in the climate measure or the weather measurements that have been published both by NOAA and by NASA. So now a lot of their data is as suspect as is the Hadley data.
Well, gentlemen, I would like to see if we can. You guys can kind of bring this to a conclusion with your thoughts here, because I guess this will be coming on to our time limit. So just go ahead and fill us in here.
Well, in terms of wrapping up, I guess I would just really like to thank Dr. Don Easterbrook for joining us, and for the work that he's done over 48 years of you know, rigorous scientific investigation, which directly bears on all these topics. It is really and of course he's also made it available on his website. I'll be having my students read some of his papers and have them listen to his interview. I think that this is you know, the voices of reason and knowledge are out there. We need to educate our politicians. We need to educate ourselves. The consequences of following blindly down this path of cap and trade towards a totalitarian system are kind of scary. And so I think, you know, again, once again, our democracy is going to be tested, and it's going to be determined to some extent by the vigilance of the average person. And so anyway, I just can't thank Don enough for joining us. It's been a great interview, and thank you again for all the great work you've done.
Well, thanks for those kind words. So in a nutshell, if people want to take away some thoughts, I would say, yeah, global warming is real, but it's nothing new. It's been going on for thousands of years and way, way more intense than what we've seen recently. The amount of CO2 in the atmosphere is so small, and the amount of increase is so small, it has virtually no effect on climate. It's physically impossible to create these absolutely devastating climatic catastrophes that are being predicted just by using an increase in CO2 alone, because it all hinges on water vapor, and there's no evidence whatsoever that water vapor is changing. The models that are used by the IPCC and various others have failed miserably, even in a 10-year projection, so why should we believe them over a 100-year projection? The sun is doing things that it hasn't done in 200 years, and is certainly going to continue to do it for some time. And the last time it did this, 200 years ago, we had a very dramatic global cooling. So it looks like we're in for global cooling. The oceans, the PDO, the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, is telling us that we're in for about two or three decades of global cooling. So don't throw away your overcoats yet. We're probably headed for global cooling, not global warming. So don't worry about global warming, but worry a lot about global cooling. And so with that, let's hope that sense prevails. And in the end, the data speaks much louder than the rhetoric. Look at the data.
Well, Don and Eric, I want to thank you both for doing the interview, and you can reach Don at just typing in Don Easterbrook in Google, and then that should bring up your website. And Eric?
Yes, you'll see the first entry.
Okay, and then Eric, you can get a hold of his website at www.naturalclimatechange.us. And that he should have a link to this interview, and then of course with www.givemesometruth.info, you can also reach this interview there.
So, okay, well, thanks so much for allowing us to do this, Melody. It's been great.
Okay, well, thank you. Good night.
Okay, so long, Don. Thank you again.
Bye.
Yeah, bye.